Track 13, Victorian Christmas at the Vicarage. Our historian, Chris Armstrong, discovers what a Victorian Norfolk Christmas was like from his great-grandfather, the Reverend B.J. Armstrong's diaries.
A few years ago, I was asked by Susanna Wade Martins whether I planned to write a biography of my great-grandfather, Benjamin John Armstrong, the diarist and vicar of East Dereham between 1850 and 1888. If not, she said she would like to write one. It was very kind of her to ask. I was delighted at the suggestion and readily agreed. I have long felt that biographies by family members are rarely entirely objective. In 2018, her biography was published, A Vicar in Victorian Norfolk, and I realized how right I had been to leave it to her. The impeccably researched book gave insights into the life of my ancestor that were new to me, despite my having frequently read every word of the 11 volumes of his diary, with its almost daily entries, and having edited the third volume of extracts from those diaries to be published as Under the Parson's Nose. The choice of a Victorian country parson as the subject for the Christmas edition of Norfolk Magazine seems apposite. Many of our Christmas traditions stem from that period when the Germanic influence of Prince Albert encouraged the introduction of Christmas trees, when many of our favourite carols were written, when Christmas cards became the norm, and at a time before travel and changing social circumstances diluted and dispersed the family circle. It was a time too when the church was still central to the life of a local community. Even at other times of the year, the normal Sunday services at Dereham regularly boasted congregations of over 1,000. At Christmas, the church was even busier, and not just for traditional Christmas services. Quite apart from the communion and afternoon services, there were weddings, christenings, and even the occasional funeral to be taken. Christmas was clearly a popular time for weddings. In 1866, Armstrong's diary entry for December 25th included, "Married a young parishioner, by the name Mahershala Lashbash Took." He accounted for the possession of such an extraordinary name thus: his father wished to call him by the shortest name in the Bible, and for that purpose selected Uz, but the clergyman making some demur. The father said, in pique, "If he can't have the shortest name, he shall have the longest." One hopes that not all weddings required the parson to cope with such tongue twisters. In 1858, Great-Grandfather outdid the 1994 Hugh Grant film Four Weddings and a Funeral. He took 5 weddings, a funeral, and a clutch of christenings, as well as the normal Christmas service, all on Christmas Day. The weddings probably didn't fill him with Christmas cheer. After one earlier wedding, he had written, "All weddings are alike. The mind reverts to new well-fitting white gloves and bouquets from Covent Garden, postboys with huge favours and smirking servant girls, a handsome breakfast with lots of champagne, wretched speeches on the parts of the men and tears on the part of the women. The bridegroom takes another glass, an old shoe is thrown into the carriage for luck, and off they go. All then go home conscious of a day lost and in a maudlin state of sentimentality caused partly by the champagne. For my own part, I dislike weddings and would sooner attend a funeral." He was a little ambivalent about parties too. While he appears to have enjoyed entertaining at home, he was, perhaps, not the ideal party guest. Following one post-Christmas party, he recorded in the diary, "In the evening to a party at Mr. Aufre's. Very slow. Small rooms. Piano out of tune. Bad wine. And stupid people." Entertaining at home was a different matter. On Christmas Day, 1856, he recorded, "Gave a very short sermon in the afternoon, after which our four darlings sat around the festive turkey and shouted with glee at the pudding all on fire. In the evening, entertained them, together with the choristers, with a magic lantern, carol singing, dancing, and snapdragon, to their great delight. Snapdragon was a popular Christmas game, although it probably wouldn't pass health and safety regulations today. Raisins were placed into a shallow dish filled with brandy. All lights were extinguished and the brandy set afire. The objective of the game was for the children to remove and eat the raisins without getting burnt. What the parents made of the choristers spending Christmas evening at the vicarage isn't recorded, but the children certainly deserved a Christmas treat. On the evening of Christmas Eve in 1860, an exceptionally cold month, they had been persuaded by one of the parishioners to stand outside in the ice-bound vicarage garden and sing carols for the benefit of those sitting by the fire in the drawing room. Their reward was to be invited back the next night to repeat their performance, inside and by the fire. Christmas trees and decorations were becoming popular. The first one in the vicarage appeared in 1855, an illuminated tree glittering with cheap presents, quote, for not just the household, but also for 24 children from the national school who had come to sing carols. The following year, there was a special treat when the family were invited to see a tree at the home of the German lady, Mrs. Rearsby. On the tree were 300 wax lights, besides all sorts of knick-knacks. Quote, Christmas for the vicar was always busy, always important as a family gathering, but not always happy. It was just after Christmas in 1855 that the vicar's baby daughter, Gertrude, died at less than a year, an event which would cast a pall over subsequent Christmases too. But he was too busy with parochial duties to sit at home and grieve. Christmas was not all parties, entertainment, good food, and warm rooms for everyone. True, in 1862, one Norwich man bred no less than 9,000 geese to kill and sell for Christmas. And the vicar himself sent Norfolk turkeys to friends and relations everywhere. But there was a distinct Dickensian feel to the stories of the poor. The vicar knew this well, and he had formed his own database of those in need. Handwritten, of course. As a result of his comprehensive plan of visiting every home in the parish, and he used this record extensively to target such help as he could bring, especially at Christmas, and the help was significant. Just before Christmas in 1859, he was fully occupied. Quote, "This week my busiest in the year, we have to decorate the church, distribute 400 loaves, also the clothing charities, to give our soup to 40 families, to send out Christmas dinners, to give shoe club tickets, etc. Add to this a couple of weddings, the regular daily service, sermons to prepare, and the sick to tend." There are similar entries in almost every year, and it is clear that ensuring that the poor and needy were as well provided for as possible was a priority. There were some small local church charities which helped, but much fell on the shoulders of the vicar and his helpers. Even the soup, throughout the colder winters, had to be given to the poor, was the produce of the vicarage kitchen. Even the charities created work. The 400 loaves, when kept in the church, caused such a rush that some wound up in the hands of those who didn't need the help. By 1854, the vicar was spending a whole day riding around his parish, distributing the bread to those who were genuinely in need. Without a horse, he was known by some in the parish as Jockey Armstrong. The task would have taken 3 days, he wrote. Christmas as today was celebrated in different families in different ways. But in Dereham in the late 19th century, the joy of family life for those in comfortable circumstances involved many new aspects, such as trees, cards, and carols that are still with us today. For the less fortunate, it was a key part of the vicar's role to render their Christmas special too. A biographical note. Benjamin John Armstrong was a Londoner from a financially comfortable background, his father having sold the family business at a young age and became a rentier. The family built its social position as though they were playing Monopoly. their home when the diarist was born on the Old Kent Road, and by gradual steps they moved up the ladder to a London home in Upper Wimpole Street, and a country residence in the then rural area of Southall. There was a family tradition of public service. Armstrong Sr. was a JP, a visiting magistrate at Hamwell Asylum, and a deputy lieutenant of Middlesex. He was also a director of a number of companies, including the Metropolitan Railway when it built its first underground train in the world. The diarist, who was strongly opposed to clergy becoming magistrates, eschewed such fripperies, but was, as were many contemporary clergy, as much an unpaid social worker as a parson. Throughout his life he kept a diary, in which he recorded not just parish events, but also national and international matters. His entries were sometimes acerbic, frequently amusing, and were always acutely observed. He was the first in a line of Norfolk clergy. His elder son was the incumbent first at Heydon and then at North Tuddenham, though his younger son elected for a military career, being mentioned in dispatches when part of the expedition to relieve Gordon at Khartoum. My father, son of the elder son of the diarist, was the incumbent of Thorpe St. Andrew before moving to be vicar at St. Margaret's, King's Lynn, now the Minster. He died in retirement in 1955.